This episode sponsored by Healthy Cell. Healthy Cell is different than typical supplements because it's a gel, not pills. Healthy Cell uses microgel technology, which is clinically proven to absorb 165% better than traditional pills. That means your body actually uses the nutrients, so you can feel the difference. And instead of swallowing a handful of vitamins, one great-tasting gel pack can replace up to 18 pills. Healthy Cell formulas are created by physicians and nutritionists to support energy, focus, immune health, and overall wellness. If you're going to take vitamins, they should actually work. Healthy Cell. Reach your potential.
Well, hi everybody. Welcome back to Gray Malkin Lane. It's Country Western Month, and I am joined by two incredible writers, Jeremy Whitley and B. Earl are here with me today. Jeremy's returning to the show. It is B. Earl's first time on the show. What a joy to have you both here. We're going to have a great time today. All month on Gray Malkin Lane, we've been talking about cowboys and Marvel's kind of weird subset of 1950s cowboy western genre and how it all fits into our universe. Now, this is an X-Men show. There are plenty of cowboy X-Men themed stories. One of them lands very loosely or tangentially in a weird series called Astonishing Wolverine and Spider-Man. Now, I've been covering Wolverine's early origins on the show a little bit consecutively, and this is one of the stories that flags in Wolverine's early origins because of one specific part of the story. We're going to get to the review in our latter half, but reading this was an undertaking, so I'm always grateful to guests who are willing to do crazy homework. Let me welcome you both to the show. I'd love to have you both share your name and pronouns, tell everybody a little bit about you. And my initial question today, do you have any connection to cowboys, country western, famous movies or TV shows, or whatever flags for you from your real life or your fictional pursuits? That's where we'll start today.
Thank you so much, Chad. I'm so grateful to be here. Yes, you can call me Ben going forward, but B. Earl, there's a whole story there as well, as we will maybe find out on this adventure.
I mean, I'm ready for that story now.
So it's interesting. My name is a challenging one. The last name growing up was Jackendoff.
I hear it. Yeah.
There you go. So, this is, I don't often talk through this story on many podcasts, but since you asked, I will give this story. You know, so I was always sort of in the background of many things and, you know, film editor, etc. And you had to change my name for one movie I edited called Christian Mingle. The director, Corbin Burnson, was like, I don't know if you can use this name on a movie for Christian mingling. And so, my name was like, you know, front card. So I changed it to my mom's maiden name of Earl. But then I was kept using my last name on a lot of other things. My son, we gave him officially the last name Earl. That is, he's now going to be 15. But many moons ago, he was given that last name. So he is officially on record with the last name of Earl, thinking that, you know, this would be a better name for him to go to high school with, which he's in now, and thanks me every day for having given him that name. So I've been writing with Marvel for the past, 8, 9 years. I mean, first book I did was with my original name, with Masters of the Sun, that I did with the Black Eyed Peas, and that was put out through Marvel. And then Taboo and I teamed up to start doing some other projects with Marvel. We did Marvel 1000, we did a Red Wolf one page, and then from there jumped off on Werewolf by Night and Deadly Neighborhood Spider-Man and Daredevil and Echo and Spirits of Vengeance and Blade and Echo, blah, blah, blah. So I'm actually right now working on an independent project that is Western themed and driven. It starts in the 1860s. So I've been really doing a lot of deep diving and digging into that. It's a modern day story, but, and it's not time travel. It's more of a golem slash immortal story. And then growing up, you know, we had a relative who had a tobacco farm in Virginia. So I remember as a kid growing up, going down to, I don't know if that's that's really Western, though. I mean, I guess tobacco. Spitting sure. tobacco. Sure.
Like, Wolverine and Sabretooth could definitely fight in a tobacco field. Immediately Western.
Right. So there you go.
You know, Hangman Adam Page is from Virginia, and he's rocked a whole Western gimmick for like 10 years now. So.
Well, speaking of Christian Mingle, that's where I first met Jeremy Whitley. Jeremy, welcome back to
Oh, nice segue. Boy,
wild thing, play people you meet around there. Yeah, thank you for having me back. I'm Jeremy Whitley. I am a writer of a lot of things, most of which are comic book. Just last year I had a Stonewall honored book, Navigating With You, which is sort of a queer YA romance about two girls who fall in love over their shared love of manga. I've been all over the place. People might know me from my series Princeless, or from working on Marvel on The Unstoppable Wasp and Future Foundation, or maybe from writing 60 issues of My Little Pony comics. But I've been
which
all
is
around.
Easily the gayest thing you've done.
I don't know, man. I'm setting new records on that front, I feel like, on a regular basis, writing wise. But yeah, I do all of that. I also have my own podcast, Progressively Horrified, which is all about watching scary movies and talking about the progressive politics that are or sometimes aren't in them. But mostly, a lot of horror movies have a lot of progressive politics in them. So my tata, my dad's stepdad, huge Western fan, I was forced to watch many because he would fall asleep in front of them, and as soon as you tried to change the channel, would immediately wake back up and make you turn it back. So, you know, I got to know Westerns early. I got to love them quite a bit later. But I'm a sucker for Westerns, and I guess just recently started writing my own, the first like sort of Western inspired thing that I do, which is a comic that I just funded through Zoop called Slay, which is sort of a futuristic monster hunting Western, which also takes place in Virginia, strangely. So
three things we all have in common. I don't know your direct ages, but I think we are of a similar age. We are all parents. And one of the things I want to focus our initial conversation on is the transforming world around us, which is a crazy thing. We're going to loop this back into Westerns in a minute, I promise, because we're going to land in time travel. But as each of us are seeing our children come up in a very different world than the ones that we were brought up in, one of the questions I want to start with for both of you, and I'm going to throw a couple characters your way for each of you, focusing a little on your Marvel stuff, but I'd love for you to reference anything that you're writing. Writing kids these days, writing the resilience of children, what it means to be an outlaw, what it means to be a hero, what it means to be a villain, and how we are kind of redefining those things in the eyes of younger characters is a really fascinating thing. And I see you guys write this stuff, and there's some commonalities in the way that I see you both tackle this as we look at this kind of next generation level. I'm always frustrated, but also so thrilled that you get to write so many indigenous characters, but it frustrates me because you should be writing so much more than just indigenous characters, right? Like there's a lot more that should be happening. So let's kind of open this idea, the concept being writing younger heroes, redefining legacy. How do we capture that? Let's start with Jake Gomez, a character that you got to create at Marvel as the new Werewolf by Night.
That's a fun place to start. So Jake Gomez, tackling that character was really the idea of how do we bring a character that's very like a WB or CW type hero into this storytelling, right? Like someone who's that Twilight version, but not, you know, where...
I was going to call out, his name's literally Jacob, so it tells me you're on Team Jacob for sure.
Well, it's funny, so there's a reason why. So Jimmy Gomez, that's Taboo's real name, and Gomez became the last name, and Jake, being that Jay, you know, Jimmy, Tab has a lot of, you know, there's a lot of Jays in his family, but Jake was also our editor, Jake Thomas. So we were like, all right, Jake, we're going to give you a bone here. Gomez is Taboo's last name, and now we got Jake Gomez. There we go. So there's a lot of like really fun references in the story. Like I put some of my best friends, actually, they were all the like racist bad guys in the very beginning. I put all my friends as, not that they are, but I was like, I'm going to do something, you guys. I hope you don't mind, but you get to be in a comic book and you get to be a bunch of jerks. No, I mean, so Jake Gomez really was this idea of how do we take someone who is sort of, you know, rebellious and a badass, but, you know, also a child, really. I mean, he's 17. So, you know, that was jumping into that storytelling was like, what was I like at 17, you know, and talking with Tab a lot. And that's, you know, our writing process I mean, in how I write with Taboo is very much about like, yo, talk to me, you know, tell me stuff. So a lot of it's more on me doing like research, I guess you could say, downloading it all, filtering it, synthesizing it, and then generating that character. So a lot of it was coming from, you know, Tab's upbringing, being a kid, you know, in Hollywood, being, you know, rebellious, growing up with his grandmother, and then my own background of, you know, just being this kid, you know, in a small town, living this life with, you know, these, you know, my best friend who was a girl growing up. So like amalgamating all of that, and that really became Jake Gomez. So a lot of these characters you see are sort of these myriads of life characters in my world and in Taboo's world. I even put, so my son is in the Daredevil and Echo book. He's the kid who is Lior. Like, so, you know, we're always putting people we know, we love, maybe we don't like, you know, as this is what writers do, right? I don't like you. I'm going to kill you off in my story, you know, or just make you be a real jerk.
So delving into these 70s characters that have kind of more modern characters replacing them, again, kind of in the lines of diversity. Jeremy, focusing on your most recent Marvel book in Strange Tales, do you want to talk a little about working with Gwen Stacy, Ghost Spider, and even Shuri as kind of the newer Black Panther character? Again, newer generation capturing older hero legacies.
What's fun with that one is, you know, we wanted to do something that would be a seasonally appropriate, you know, Halloween story, something that people can pick up every year, that, you know, would get younger audiences in the door. So, you know, we were thinking like who has fun like Halloween theme, who is somebody we can do something with that, you know, is sort of doing a unique thing story-wise within the Halloween structure. And we were like, we want everybody to be some sort of Halloween archetype. So, you know, she is both a ghost and a spider, and pretty literally ghost-like throughout this thing. So it was fun to get to sort of play with her as a young up-and-coming character. And we did this, what I feel like was more daring as I was writing it than I realized when I pitched it, of like her fighting Norman as the Green Goblin, which is very like, you know, that's the guy that killed Arguin Stacy. So like putting them in the same room together and having them fight, not really, neither of them really knowing who the other one is, was a really like interesting dynamic to put on that. I love the young like teen Marvel characters. You know, in that same book, I got to use Nico Minoru, who's one of my favorites, who I had not gotten a chance to write, even though I kept trying to squeeze her into everything before that. So, you know, they really wanted to do Scarlet Witch, and I was like, well, I think it would be fun to have this sort of tie of like having an old witch and a young witch from these different generations with you know, Wanda and Nico, you know, having them showing the very like different ways that they interact both with the world and with their powers was a lot of fun. And then, I mean, Shuri is a ball to write. There's such a big gap between who she is in the comics and who she is in the movies that there's this sort of weird space to play in. But we got to sort of mess around with that a little bit and do a little bit of each, and throwing her up against, you know, a rampaging Hulk with you know, two of her guards by her side was a lot of fun to play with. It's like, you know, what would she do differently than, you know, we've seen Black Panther take on Hulk before, we've seen T'Challa do it, so, you know, how's Shuri gonna do it that's different? So it's sort of fun to play with those dynamics and putting these characters together who've never been together before. And just even like one of the things that was fun about Unstoppable Wasp as well is getting to plug in these younger characters into these types of stories that we don't really tell as much anymore. Westerns is one of those, obviously, but also with hers, it was a real like big 50s science action, right? Like, we don't do science adventures all that much anymore. And, you know, young teenage girls were not featured really in those stories when they were popular.
Yeah.
So it's fun to sort of take that, you know, the new characters and the new ideas and fit them into those types of stories and do something that hasn't been done with it.
Yeah, you're both excellent at writing young characters. Jeremy, if you listen to the show, last August, I did the trial of David Cannon, The Whirlwind. So I do one big academic panel once a month. We reference you writing Janet Van Dyne beating the shit out of him really actively. But in May on my show, we're doing the trial of Janet Van Dyne. So stay tuned, because we have a lot to say about your Unstoppable Wasp run. I love it very much, my friend. Ben, jumping back into that same kind of space, I really love your character, Dream Dream Spider as well. Crystal Katani, do you want to talk about the same topic, but do you want to talk about the creation of this character?
Yeah, you know, she's one of my favorites too to have been able to create, because she, I mean, so backstory, huge horror fan, right? Like growing up, not so much as a kid, but as soon as I like got over my fear of like Jason and all that, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, horror is amazing. So Freddy Krueger, hands down, one of the, like, my favorite characters. And Tav and I always would talk about like horror stories and horror, you know, characters that we loved. And, you know, going into this, it was like, all right, we have an opportunity here to create something, you know, fun and cool. And this idea of taking, you know, all those horror tropes and kind of throwing it into one. And, you know, Crystal Katani and Dream Spider is, in my opinion, she's Freddy Krueger, but like the good version. She comes in your dreams and, you know, fights all the bad dream monsters away instead of trying to kill you in your dreams. What was always really interesting about her is that, you know, there's just so much, you know, depth to dream psychology, sort of that space. And I love playing in that space personally. She was originally going to be called Story or Story Spider. And then Nick Lowe was like, but well, we should call her Dream Spider, or, you know, he threw a few names at us. And that was the one that really stuck, you know, as sort of getting that by issue 4, as we named her, because throughout I was always thinking of her as this like keeper of stories. So in the story, you know, she's got that rock. Well, that Peter got was the rock, and the rock has all the stories, and it's connected to Ea, and it's, you know, got all these like elements connected to it, and the whole story of, you know, the shooting the arrows and blah blah blah, whatever. If you've read the, you know, I know you've read it, Chad. I'm sure people in the audience, maybe they haven't read it. I you know, I won't spoil things.
It's so pretty. It's a pretty book. Worth for the art alone. And then the story, of course, is incredible. But it's a beautiful book.
I mean, Juan Ferreira, by the way, big shout out to Juan. Juan was such a pleasure to work with.
Yeah, I've had Juan on the show. What a great guy. Yeah.
Oh, man. He's the greatest. You know what I always say? Working with Juan was like playing jazz. Because, you know, there'd be elements of the writing and how I would come up with the panels, and then Juan would come back with his version, and I'd be like, oh, okay, I see where you're going with this. So, and sometimes those would happen, and we would be getting it, you know, all the pages would come back, and then it would be like, and now we have to go to letters. So I'd be like literally rewriting it around his his panels and changes that always made it better, by the way. You know, I always defer to the artist, but, you know, that was such a fun story to write, and really would love to see more with her. We got to do that little one shot, like, I guess you could call it a one shot, 10 pager in Edge of the Spider-Verse, where we got to introduce Uncle Ruckus, was going to be her, you know, big bad, made up of all the fear of all the children. But yeah, I mean, she is really the keeper of stories, in my opinion. And dreams are the place where so many of our stories, you know, sort of come from or are kept, you know, deep in our subconscious and maybe collective unconscious. So that is, she's very Jungian, I guess, in her devising.
So taking a slight step backward, we're talking about writing a younger generation. Let's talk about the younger generation that was introduced 20 years ago. You've written lots of characters like this, but if we focus on Wiccan and Hulkling, when those characters were introduced in 2005, they became kind of the face of gay relationships for a whole new generation of people in a time when gay marriage hasn't passed yet. And now they're like the couple, like almost, it seems like people are afraid to do things with them almost because of that archetype they're stuck in a little bit. But you got to write these characters. And writing them alongside some of my favorite writers like Josh Trujillo and Anthony Oliveira, who've gotten to use these characters as well.
I love Wiccan and Hulkling. The Young Avengers collectively are one of my favorite groups of characters. But I think, you know, Wiccan and Hulkling is such an interesting relationship. They are so complicated as characters because God bless all the creators on this series initially, because like you took two of the most like already very complicated families of Marvel stuff in the, you know, Captain Marvel side of things, and then in the Maximoff side of things, and you just not only like put them together but made them more complicated by doing so.
Yeah, you know, a half you know, Kree warrior mixed with a Skrull princess on one side, and then half like devil baby mixed with the android and witch essence of a, yeah, we don't, it's crazy times.
It's I remember very distinctly, like, I love getting into, like, real messy continuity in comics. As anybody who's read Unstoppable Wasp can tell you, I devoted almost a whole issue to outlining who her family is and who she is and isn't related to, including Wiccan and Hulkling, I guess, but Wiccan specifically.
But also including Tigra's baby by a Skrull.
Yes. Yes, by a Skrull pretending to be Hank at the time. Yeah, and so, like, it's there's such a temptation with them to go off in one of the many, many different ways that you can go with either of those families and trying to sort of, like, get to the ground on either of those continuities is pretty difficult. But, like, also just making them an honest queer relationship, I particularly enjoy Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey's version of them as being sort of complicated. I think, you know, having worked with them in the past to some extent and having pitched a lot of stuff New Avengers related that has not seen the light of day, I can tell you that Marvel is very protective of that group of characters, and Brevoort in particular is very protective of the young Avengers. So I do think it's this rough kind of thing of, I think this happens with a lot of different types of queer stories, and is something that, you know, I'm dealing with myself and doing a sequel to Navigating With You, of like, when you tell queer romances in sort of that context, especially with young characters, I think there's a tendency for them to become sacred to both the audience and to the people reading it. And I do think at some level there's got to be a burden on the writer to be honest about what relationships are like, and that not every first queer relationship ends up with you getting married. In fact, I would argue most of them don't, just like most relationships, and historically probably even more of them for obvious reasons. So, like, it's a tough thing to try and tell those stories honestly while also, like, giving people room for a happy ending, even if it's just a temporary one.
Ben, another character that falls into this genre, early 2000s, maybe late 90s, another character that I adore is Maya Lopez, or Echo, who has gone on to kind of have her own mythology. I know this is not one you created, obviously, as well, but taking this character and creating new stories in her post-Phoenix Force era, which is wild already. Do you want to talk about your work with Echo? You've done a lot of really beautiful things with her.
Well, thank you. You know, she was a tough one to jump into with the Daredevil and Echo, because that is such a heavy two-hander, where Daredevil, you know, obviously becomes... It's hard when you have such a big character like Daredevil and they're both in the title, right? Like, how do you give her a major component to the story? And then, of course, we got thrown in and was like, can we put in Ghost Rider? So, like, you know, I've got this reveal with Ghost Rider coming in, and they're like, all right, now we got a three-hander, and we only have four issues. But, you know, that was a real challenge to really make sure that Echo had her shine in Daredevil and Echo. But getting the opportunity to do the Echo one-shot just that came out last year was such a blast, because I knew I wanted so much more to do with her during Daredevil and Echo. But in a lot of ways, she, you know, and her relative, because that story was... It wasn't really time travel, but it was very much about playing with these two time periods. And it was dealing with genealogy and generational trauma, right? So there was a connection to that generational trauma with Echo and her relative going by the name of Creeping Death. But there wasn't that opportunity to really let her spread her wings in the ways that I wanted to let her do that. And we also were supposed to have five issues on that series, but we got one cut right going into issue. Like, issue one was written and it was like, by the way, we only have four issues for this. So an entire issue had to get cut. And all of a sudden it was like, zoop! Jeremy's like nodding along, going like, I know that story well.
Yeah. Every writer I've ever interviewed, it's not just you. I know, but that doesn't make it hard.
So let me tell you about my six issue ongoing series.
Oh my goodness. It's anyway, but Echo the one shot, you know, for me, getting that opportunity to revisit her and go, okay, like, what can we do with her in a way that gives her just really plays with the character. And I've been wanting to tell, like, a real crime story, really a noir vibe in that tab. Was like, yo, we got to make it happen in LA. I was like, yeah, let's do LA. Let's make it like that Chinatown. She comes to LA. She's got to solve a crime. Her cousin, always family, obviously. Family always, you know, gives a lot more high stakes when you're telling, especially a short story, right? And we were also really that project started off as, hey, we need to give Echo a new superpower, and we need to make sure that it's a superpower that allows her to get dropped into different stories, kind of like Misty Knight. So that's the vibe of Echo, right? And it was like, okay, oh, and we need this written within the next like couple weeks, and we need the pitch for her new power, over, you know. So you're like, all right, quick. To the Batcave or to the Echo Cave. Let's figure this out.
It would clearly be the Echo Chamber, though. I just want to
say. No, there you go. The Echo Chamber. The bad writer in me right now is. I just want to be in the Batcave. You know, all that. Anyway, so yeah, so that was really, you know, how do we give Echo this new power? And that was such an interesting opportunity because I'm so obsessed with symbols and symbolism and storytelling in that way. And I was like, what if we get, she's obviously, she's deaf. She doesn't have the ability. So if symbols were able to come out of her mouth and she can only read what other people, like she's reading lips, what if she could read more than just lips? And that was this idea of like this universal archetypal language. And it was also a throwback to the Deadly Neighborhood Spider-Man language that Juan and I kind of worked out in the, when Spider-Man and the Demon Bear are having that conversation, there's all these like symbols that are happening, right? So I was like, what if that's this universal archetypal language within the Marvel Universe, and she gets to actually read that coming out of people's lips? So that became like, let's make this super grounded story where it's like crime driven, and she's like doing this whole voiceover narration, you know, what do you call it, from Chinatown, Jake Giddies, right? And Jack, what was it? Yeah, right? Anyway. Yeah. And that was the kickoff, but then it all of a sudden got really weird and trippy. And it was also me going like, I am so sick of all these like crazy cults that are sucking people in that are all based in like wellness and, hey, let's do some bufo and everybody's going to get high and do ayahuasca and you're going to see God. And it's like, get the fuck out of here, man. Like, this is that. I hate that more than anything, especially in LA. And Jeremy's probably like nodding along going like, yeah, I know those people exactly that are such like phony baloney, like spiritual people. So that was really the drive with Echo, that she could see through that bullshit, right? And she could read the lies coming out of these people's mouths.
So let me ask you both one more, although obviously we could talk for hours. The other genre here is, let's take a character that's new, but put them back where they were at the very beginning. And odd one, Jeremy, I don't think you're expecting this question, but do you want to talk about the creation of the Promoter? One more Elder of the Universe out there.
Yeah, it's wild because I don't know if you've seen, but they just put out a trailer for the Marvel Tokon video game, which is the fighting game where they included the Promoter in this story.
She's more than a one-hit wonder now.
Yeah, it's so wild because like they wanted to do a Thorn Hulk story where it wasn't just them fighting the whole time, but it needed to be some sort of like competition between the two of them. And I was like, all right, I want to use the champion of the universe. I love that guy. I love the idea of this is just a dude who's like he's almost like a wrestler who just goes from like world to world. Like, I want to fight your toughest guy. Who's your toughest guy? I want to fight him. And that's his whole thing. But I was like, he's kind of boring in that, like, he doesn't really have much of a character beyond that. And I was like, well, what would you do if, like, this was a real wrestler? If it was, you know, Brock Lesnar, right? It's a guy without a personality who's just a big, big, strong dude. It's like, well, you give him a Paul Heyman. You give him a talking guy, somebody to do the promotion and the managing and everything. And I was like, well, what if we had an Elder of the Universe who was the promoter to go along with the champion of the universe? So, like, the fun thing with her was the whole concept of her powers is she is literally capable of changing the fabric of reality. She has Beyonder level powers, but she can only do it for the benefit of other people. So like she is not able to gain from her powers at all. So it's sort of a fun way, like as working for him, she can set up whatever she wants as a tournament. She can send people to whatever world, wherever's fun for them to fight, whatever's a fun goal for them to have. So, you know, she sends Thor and Hulk to an asteroid in the middle of nowhere, and they're supposed to get this belt that used to belong to a frost giant. What they don't know in that first issue is that this frost giant has been infected by the brood, so you have a frost giant sized broodling that they're fighting. And so like it's, I was like, it's this opportunity to go unlimitedly big to go, like, I was like, that's the first thing I threw out. And I was like, every issue is going to get a little bigger. We're going to go a little farther, a little wilder, except for the one where, you know, we threw in Moonstone. So Hulk and Thor have to deal with where they're really weak, which is their brains.
In both cases. I also have the trial of Moonstone out there. She's one of my all-time favorites. Love that character.
I love a character who's an evil psychologist, right? Like, just, you know, it says so much about our archetypes of superheroes. Is like, who can take them down? Well, somebody who's smart and knows how brains work, because they all have real problems. But yeah, that, she was so fun to get to play with, and I'm glad that they picked her up and threw her in this game, because she's you know, that was a 6-issue sort of throwaway Marvel Unlimited miniseries that I created this character for, knowing that she might never get picked up anywhere else, and hasn't for the last 5, 6, 7 years, however long it's been. And then somebody was like, hey, have you seen this trailer? A character you created is in it. And I was like, oh, word? Let me see what that is. And not expecting to see this, you know, white haired, you know, black woman with top hat and tails and purple eyes. And I was like, oh.
And Ben, this is an interesting one I'm going to ask you about. Again, this is not a character you created, but this concept of the character's been there from the very beginning. You got to use the Demon Bear in your recent story as well. Talk about using the Demon Bear. And can you tell people what that is? I find the Demon Bear very hard to define.
Well, you know, Demon Bear, what a great character. That was it Bill Sienkiewicz and Chris Claremont, right, that created that one? So, you know, Bill, by the way, it was so awesome to see that Bill did a variant cover for our series, The Deadly Neighborhood Spider-Man. So it was awesome to see Bill revisit the Demon Bear in a variant.
Bill is the nicest person. I got to meet him a couple years ago. What a sweetheart. Just a great guy.
So amazing. So, you know, it's funny. I mean, it's part of my own backstory. I did a documentary back in 2001 on comic books, and I got to film Bill Sienkiewicz at Columbia University. Like, you interview him. We're using Columbia University as our backdrop. Anyway, so cut to many moons later. Now I'm getting to play with Bill's character, the Demon Bear. So, you know, getting that character, it was interesting, because we were going to have Danny Moonstar be in the series. We ended up not using her for the Spider-Man series. I really wanted to throw a lot of X-Men into the Deadly Neighborhood Spider-Man series. And ultimately, the only part of that stayed in there was Demon Bear. The only character that sort of maintained any, like, still clung on, because originally there was Gambit was going to be in it. Like, there was all this huge crazy pitch that was set out, and yes, rinse, repeat, refine, finally came down to Demon Bear and creating a new character. But, you know, to me, the Demon Bear is this, like, incredible, again, I keep using the word archetype, but it's this archetype that is within all of us, this monster that sort of sits within us and is ready to rip us apart when we're not true to ourselves, right? Like,
yeah, that's kind of how I see it. It's like a being from another realm that takes on the form of your trauma and manifests, which gives it a very Cassandra Nova kind of Mumadry vibe, which is really creepy, actually.
Absolutely. And, you know, but it's like primal nature, right? It is a bear. It is this thing that, you know, is ready to rend you limb from limb, but also comes and eats all of your cookies and crackers in your tent, you know, kind of. So there's a cuteness to it. We have teddy bears. We have, you know, we've sort of taken the claws, so to speak, out of the bear and made them into these very childlike, you know, stuffies that you go to bed with. But the real true primal nature of the bear is this, you know, powerful entity within our culture. I mean, throughout culture, bears have had a lot of, like, powerful primal energy representation. And one of the things that I really didn't want to do with the Demon Bear, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about this, like, universal language, whatever. I was writing it and I was like, is the Demon Bear go, oh, Spider-Man, I'm going to get you, you know, Demon Bear, growl. You know, like, I was like, how do I have the Demon Bear communicate with Spider-Man? You know, how do I have this conversation happen? So that was, like, this huge challenge, because I felt like it was going to be so corny to have a talking bear. You know, it just felt like, put him in a top hat and kind of, you know, do a little dance, or maybe it's a her. I don't know. It's the Demon Bear. You know, what is the Demon Bear, right? What entity? I always think of it, it represents who you are, right? So anyway, yeah.
I feel like the demon bear very firmly would use they them pronouns.
Right? It's all of the above. I mean, it is, but again, it's an entity. And I think that was going into that entity was like, how do I have this demon bear speak to Spider-Man? And that's where this
I did not make up this joke. I'm just repurposing it for this conversation. But how does a non-binary demon bear kill its victims? They slash them. Yeah. 1,000 questions I want to ask each of you, but we're going to transition into our issue review. Let me just say I'm delighted to hear every story you're sharing, and I know you have 1,000 things. As writers in this day and age, in the market that exists, in the way that it is, I know the constant redefinition of self, rediscovering the joy of storytelling in the market that is out there is a lot, and you two bring so much enthusiasm and love as consistent writers working on the things that you do, and we'll talk about some of the stuff you're doing outside of Marvel, of course, when we are wrapping up at the end, but thank you for celebrating your Marvel work with me specifically today, too. We're going to jump into the world of Astonishing Spider-Man and Wolverine. This is a very self-indulgent series, it feels like to me. It's a lot, y'all. This is kind of an intense one in a lot of ways. It's a ton to keep track of. It's very word dense. But what we're doing today, kind of setting all this up, is establishing the concept of playing in this giant Marvel sandbox. So when you are doing things like time travel, you're taking two characters like Spider-Man and Wolverine, where every version of every story has already been told. And now we're bopping them around through time in different time periods. Time periods are flipping on their heads. And the premise and payoff, I'm not quite sure, is worth the investment at the end, but it's a hell of a lot of fun getting to the end of this journey. So this is a 6-issue limited series. We're not going to delve deep. My show tends to cover early continuity, but we're just mixing in things as we go, and this does have some early continuity touches. So this is Jason Aaron and Adam Kubert with Mark Morales, Dexter Vines, Justin Ponzer, Rob Steen, Dan Ketchum, and Nick Lowe are the editors, and this was produced in 2010. And the featured villain in this series, at least initially, is the Orb, who I have an episode out on. He's a guy with a giant eyeball for a head, and he has a team of orblings who all wear little masks on their faces as they go rob banks. The premise in this series is they break into a bank vault and access something called the Time Diamonds, which grow on another planet, but if you have them, you can bedazzle your shit with them and then like whack stuff and knock you through time. That's basically what happens. A couple of drug dealers who feel like uncomfortable stereotypes named Big Czar and, oh, I forgot the other one's name now.
Big Murder, isn't he?
Yeah, oh, Big Murder and the Czar. That's what their names are. Yeah, they feel like Fat Albert characters to me in the worst kind of way. They end up getting these diamonds and popping all through time. And there's all these like variant versions of them that are just trying to fuck Spider-Man and Wolverine up specifically as they're like crossing paths. It's like a Kang the Conqueror or like Cable kind of adventure as they kind of weave in and out. So we're not going to delve deep into the continuity of it all, but this is a wild ride and it's a ton of fun. And again, I've met Jason Aaron, sweetheart of a guy. He's an incredible writer and maybe the best writer in modern days of doing this kind of Conan style hyper masculinity, like I'm gonna land in the realm and conquer the world and bed the beautiful princess, like the story that we see so frequently in hero comics. He does this with Namor and he does it with Wolverine and he does it with all these characters in a very effective way.
I was reading monthly comics fairly regularly at the point this came out, and I remember I got the first issue and it was just something I'd picked up off the shelf because I didn't know anything about it. It was a little mini series. I was like, oh, I'll give it a shot. Like it's a good team, Jason Aaron and Adam Kubert. And I read the first issue and I was like, oh, this is really good. But I never picked up another issue, and reading it now, kind of, I'm grateful for that because that moment, I'm with it, and I even like some of the, you know, the traditional X-Men villain who was introduced halfway through. But boy, the moment that these new villains, Czar and Big Murder, walk on screen, I was like, oh no, oh no. Because
I would have grown to them in 1995. In 2010, I'm certainly like, oh, I don't, nope.
Yeah. Trying to write characters that speak. I don't know. This feels like Airplane. Like they speak in jive. The way that they are Chris Claremonting this dialogue and the way that they like write out accents and stuff like that is like, it's obnoxious when Chris did it in the 80s. It's wild when you're doing it with two black characters in 2010.
Yeah, it's like a white writer trying to write Luke Cage in the early 70s. It's like very jive talky. That's my least favorite part of all of this. But the time travel crazy. Wow. It's a lot as well.
Well, I'll kind of piggyback on that, what Jeremy was saying. Look, it's tough writing, you know, black characters. I had to do it in Masters of the Sun, and which was primarily all black characters, and, you know, with Will.i.am, you know, so you're kind of having to walk a very fine line when you write that, especially as a white dude, you know, writing that. And, you know, that to me, like, I can empathize with what he's doing, but I can also go like, man, like we didn't need those. As you said, Jeremy, like when they walked on the page, I just was like, really? It was so underwhelming. Like I just so like just checked out at that point. I checked out. I was like, all right. And then Mojo comes in and I'm like, well, that's fun, but now I feel like we're just spinning plates, and what are we spinning these plates for?
Okay, so I'm gonna do one issue at a time.
This episode sponsored by HealthyCell. HealthyCell is different than typical supplements because it's a gel, not pills. HealthyCell uses microgel technology, which is clinically proven to absorb 165% better than traditional pills. That means your body actually uses the nutrients, so you can feel the difference. And instead of swallowing a handful of vitamins, one great-tasting gel pack can replace up to 18 pills. HealthyCell formulas are created by physicians and nutritionists to support energy, focus, immune health, and overall wellness. If you're going to take vitamins, they should actually work. HealthyCell. Reach your potential.
And I'm going to read brief synopses. We're not going to delve deep into this. We're just going to let it be what it is. We'll talk about the problems. We'll talk about the joyful stuff. But this is a time travel. This feels like an episode of Rick and Morty, where it's so looped in on itself that it almost hurts your head. But there's a good way to do it. And then there's a way that just takes it a little too far. This series is mostly a lot of fun. And the art's pretty beautiful. Spider-Man and Wolverine have an interesting relationship. They've been on the Avengers together. They've teamed up a bunch of times. Wolverine's a killer, Spider-Man's a guilty hero. In this, they're very annoyed with each other. But, you know, fun team up, and it's Marvel's two biggest properties, frankly. So in issue number one, we open with a gorgeous action shot of Wolverine and Spider-Man leaping into action in the city against the night sky. This is Adam Kubert on cover and interiors. It's really beautiful overall, and the story is titled Another Fine Mess. We open on Peter Parker, who's been stranded in dinosaur times for months. He's making the most of his time to study dinosaurs and the stars, and he's been collecting specimens, and he also has this woman's face trapped in his dreams that he keeps carving everywhere. Now remember that, because this woman's face, well, we'll just spoil it here, we'll get to who the woman is, but at the end of the series, the scientists have found this woman's face carved in ancient times, and they're like, oh, who is she? But she's like a modern woman who we'll never see in another comic again. So anyway, there's that tie-in. We also see Wolverine living in the Valley of Fire with the small folk, and he's protecting them from the kill folk. So yes, this is the world of Moon Boy and Devil Dinosaur, who never show up at all, except kind of. So Logan goes by the name Six Claws here, and he's ruling the valley, and Spider-Man's like, you're not supposed to change the present, which both of them are changing the present, which is going to alter the future, whatever. We flash back to months ago, the Orb and the Orblings rob the stuff from the bank, and they end up with a fight with Spider-Man and Wolverine, and the Time Diamonds hit them, and we go back to the past, where a meteor then hits the Earth, and Spider-Man and Wolverine wake up millions of years in the future, where the Fall People are now an advanced civilization who are riding BattleBots version of like Devil Dinosaur into combat with the Kill Folk millions of years later. And the moral of the story is you should not mess with the timeline. Now, there are some really beautiful pinups at the back of the issue one. You get work by Nico Henrichon, Amiko Soyan, and Andres Mosa, Alex Maleev, Mark Brooks, Humberto Ramos, and Elder Delgado, Nick Bradshaw, and Jim Charlampidis. I don't know if I'm saying that name correctly.
And that Humberto Ramos and Edgar Delgado piece is amazing. I think the only issue I had read before this, and it's a tricky thing because, you know, you do this sort of starting in medias res and like, you're okay, there's this huge problem we have to take care of, and they jump back to, you know, where this all started, and it really works as long as the journey, like the destination, ends up being worth the journey, which I'm not sure it entirely was, but like the journey itself is really like interesting and engaging. I kind of like this, you know, version of Spider-Man, and Wolverine is sort of the same version of Wolverine he always is. He's just a little more feral than usual.
For the 10 people who know this reference, I feel like this issue or this series was written specifically for Strong Bad from Homestar Runner. If you know that reference.
Oh my God.
Strong Bad!
Yes!
Like the one-armed Trogdor burning down the village. Like,
oh my God. Wow, that is some early 2000s flash animation.
And that is absolutely what Strong Bad would call Wolverine, is his six claw.
Six claw.
Yeah.
This is my original character, six claw.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Well, Strong Bad would be Wolverine, and he would cast Homestar Runner as like the lame Spider-Man, and then he'd get the babe from the Teen Girl Squad, right? Like we're going Homestar Runner here. Okay, on the cover, Wolverine is aiming a Phoenix gun right at us. Y'all, when they try to weaponize this cosmic force of the Phoenix Force into something like a bullet and a gun, it annoys the shit out of me so much. I hate it. I really, it's one of the tropes I dislike the most. But anyway, that's what happens here. So we're in this future of highly advanced cavemen. Spidey and Wolverine have found a building full of dead weapons, and we see a severed arm in there. It might be Cable's or the Winter Soldier's, but Iron Man's armor, Cap's shield, a cosmic cube that's not working, Dr. Octopus's tentacles, everyone's dead. They pass the ruins of, quote, Garbanzo's Superhero Wax Museum, and an exhibit of History's Lamest Heroes display, where the only really recognizable character is Squirrel Girl, and fuck that, because she's amazing. The Fall People see Logan as their messiah, because they have memories of him from millions of years ago, but he's not interested. There's a fight with some old robots. Spidey sees the Orb, who's now all buff and time traveling, and he's ranting about the Minutemen who are trying to sort out all the time crazy. And also, watch out for the Tsar, who we don't know who that is at this point. And then Doom the Living Planet shows up, and Spider-Man has somehow packaged the Phoenix Force into a single bullet and made a gun for it. So it's kind of like the ultimate nullifier, if you guys know that Marvel device, where like if you shoot it, it's gonna kill you. Wolverine knocks him out, takes the gun, names it Genie, and then meanwhile we see someone dripping in diamonds is watching, and that's the big murder character who's just decked out and bedazzled in these timed items. Okay, that's issue two. Ben, thoughts?
Whoa! I mean, you know, this is a journey. It is a journey. I really was in it for this issue. Like, I was really, like, vibing this one because I was like, all right, this is getting wild. Like, we're just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was seeing the payoffs from issue one where I was feeling like, all right, cool. Like, we had that set up. Now we're in the future. There's, you know, ramifications of what happened in issue one. And I really liked Wolverine's costume in this. Like, I just felt like he looked, you know, almost like a mixture of samurai and native. Like, he kind of reminded me a little of like, I don't know if it would be Thunderhawk or one of those, you know, he has it looked cool. It just looked cool. And the artwork in this, I mean, obviously, Adam Kubert is fantastic.
Spider-Man has the word lame written on his ass through this whole issue.
Does he really? Oh my God, he does! I'm looking back at it right now.
That's when he gets his costume, because he doesn't have, like, his costume is torn up when they're in the far future or the far past, and so that display in the museum
of
the superheroes, right? The costume has been taken off the Spider-Man that's up front, and so that's what he's wearing, is the costume from the display.
So this, I love that.
This is high level, like Mad Max shit. Robot Devil, yeah. Dinosaur, the Phoenix Gun, and Doom the Living Planet. It's a lot, friends.
It's a lot. But by the way, that Doom design, pretty freaking cool.
I prefer my Doom as a T-Rex, though.
There's that. That's like the fiery eyes, like over the Tappan Zee Bridge or whatever it was, the Brooklyn Bridge.
The story's a lot of fun. My biggest problem with this issue is that it's the same issue as the first issue, which is like, you pick up, they've been in this place for a while, they're separated, they hate each other, a big event is coming, they have to deal with the big event and they warp off to some other time.
Issue 3, Spider-Man and Wolverine with a cosmic cube on the cover. Logan kills the Doom, the living planet, with the Phoenix gun, but he ends up evaporating. Spidey holds a vigil for him on the fallen torch of the Statue of Liberty, which is giving very Planet of the Apes vibes, which is one more layered reference I'm not sure we needed. Wolverine is set to enjoy the afterlife. His mother, the character Paul Jenkins created in the Origin series, is calling to him, you know, James, I'm here. But Spidey uses the cosmic cube to bring Wolvie back to life and naked, and he is displeased, at least at first. They fight, then they get yanked out of time again, and this time adult Spider-Man ends up with young James Howlett, fresh from the Origin 2 series, living in the woods with the wolves. So this is the Claremont backstory before Weapon X gets him. I mean, that's a long time later, but this is when he's initially in his Savage era. So adult Spider-Man is in teen Logan's Arctic wilderness, and adult Wolverine ends up with Spider-Man, who's brand new with his powers, getting ready to go do the whole costumed wrestling thing from like Amazing Spider-Man 15. Okay, Jeremy, thoughts?
Man, I don't.
I'm doing my best, guys.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. He's doing his best to like go, you know, dance between the raindrops here and like put them into each other's origins, or at least their early days. The Spider-Man here feels like wildly out of character. That, you know, the wrestler Spider-Man is really like, he feels like a mid 20s, early 30s scumbag, and like he's supposed to be like what, 16 here?
It's really, I look out for myself.
Yeah, and he comes across, especially more in the fourth issue, is very like guy who knows too much about wrestling, who just keeps talking about it the whole time.
Okay, issue 4. This is where it loses me. The first three are kind of a high octane, like heavy metal, you know, ride. Then I'm just like, okay. We're now bouncing around time. We meet Big Murder and the Czar. One is a tall black man. One's a little, they're drug dealers. They've got the time diamonds and decked themselves out. They feel like blaxploitation era characters. And if they were written by a black person, I might be more sympathetic, but these two characters are just offensive, and we're just gonna move on and let it be what
they have. They have a whole palace full of women that they've stolen from all of time to just stay there and I guess be their harem, which is
he says it, he's like, where's my harem?
They're filming rap videos or something. I don't know. They spar with the Knights Templar. They send one into the bombing of Hiroshima. And suddenly we go all Bill and Ted. Bill and Ted, you guys have seen these movies. They like are collecting people from time, having an adventure, right? We go Bill and Ted, and they get to see that we see their secret hideout. There's the harem. Helen of Troy is here. Joan of Arc is here. James Brown, Jimi Hendrix, Miles Davis, Cleopatra,
like Bill and Ted.
Marie Antoinette. Like, it's a bizarre setup here. They just have yanked people out of time. They even meet other versions.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, the porn parody. This is what the setup for it would be.
Bill and Ted.
Love it. I need to go make this one.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. That's what we would call it.
Excellent. Love it. Let's love.
There's more team ups with Wolverine and Teen Spider-Man and Adult Spidey and Teen Wolverine. I'm really not going to get lost in it. But this is an official part of Wolverine's origin, because this is apparently the 616, even though all the alternate future stuff isn't. But in this, we see Logan get tracked down by Dog Logan. And this is where things get a little bit complicated. So if you guys have read Origin by Paul Jenkins, it's really well done. Dog Logan is the character that was kind of intended to be Sabretooth, but maybe also Logan's. Anyway, Jason Aaron later uses this guy in Wolverine and the X-Men, because at the end of this story, Dog Logan gets his hands on some of the time diamonds and becomes like a time-traveling villain who then attacks the Jean Grey School for Higher Learning. But this is the only part of this issue I want to read. He says, "Little brother, you hear me, Jamie boy? It's your old pal Dog. You should have killed me when you had the chance. Did you think I was just going to forget about you, huh? I remember you every time I look in the mirror, you little runt."
Isn't it that they are maybe related? That like so Logan was the groundskeeper where he was born, and I think there's like an implication that perhaps our James Howlett is actually the son of the groundskeeper, that like illegitimate son of the groundskeeper. I don't know, man. This it's, part of continuity
is possible, but never confirmed. So the groundskeeper Logan is like, James takes his name from that guy, and Dog is is his son. So he says, I remember our daddy too. How about you? You remember the man you gutted like a fish with them claws of yours? Oh, so the implication you're implying, Jeremy, is that the gardener might have been James's dad.
I thought that was supposed to be the case, but I don't know that that's ever confirmed.
I feel like that's hinted at, but never canonized. That's what I'm remembering, yeah. If I'm going correct. I know he wasn't much, but he was all I had until you took him away, just like you took everything that should have been mine. You didn't deserve none of it. It's just like your mama said, James, you know, right before she blowed her damn brains out. You're an animal, a rabid little animal, and I'm here to put you down. So that's the speech we get. This guy's after Logan. And then from here, he gets to jump forward in time. He's like a little pioneer dude.
I mean, I think my favorite moment was when he came back and he was like, you should have left me dead. You know? But I think that was an issue 3. But, you know, I kind of liked this character. It brought me sort of back into it after Thar. And, you know, like you said, like, that was a great speech. I was like, yeah, this is some Jason Aaron. Like, I love Jason Aaron. He's such a fantastic writer. And this was like some really just Jason Aaron meat that I was like, yeah, give it to me, you know, after the Czar and Murderface or whatever his name was.
Oh, God. Yeah, the one thing that's funny to me about this is I know Jason Aaron is from the American Southeast like I am. He's from the South. And he writes Dog, who is a Canadian redneck, as if he is an American redneck. Like, he just writes him with a very, like, Southern accent, whereas should have a lot more, like, long vowels in here.
So we bounce through time again. Logan and Spider-Man end up getting burned during the Salem witch trials, which is just a trope we see often. And then we zoom out to Harvey Weinstein, Mojo, who's in his little chair ranting about wanting to give the people what they want. Ben, are you a Mojo fan?
You know, when Mojo, as soon as they started doing the TV thing, I was like, oh, here comes Mojo. I like Mojo. I mean, there's like, was it, gosh, I remember a series ages ago, back in the 90s, where I'm pretty sure Mojo was the main villain, and there was just, it was fun. It just felt like, and then of course reality TV comes around, and it's like, oh wait, this is a little too close to home. I mean, somebody must have taken a page out of Mojo's book when we started doing reality television. But yeah, I like Mojo. I think I wanted to use Mojo in a story at one point and ended up not getting the opportunity to, but yeah. And MODOK is another. Mojo and MODOK, right? Like, you, these giant, one's a big fat head and one's a big fat body. Now, what would happen if Mojo and MODOK had a baby? I don't know.
That would be the Captain America villain, the Slug. Everyone go look that character up if you would like. We jump to Astonishing Spider-Man Wolverine number 4, where Big Murder and the Czar make the cover. Don't worry about it. And then on page 1, we get the Spider-Man and Wolverine show. Spider-Man's going booyah, and Wolverine's going snick-ditty-snick. Here comes the stabbing. This looks like the mini Marvels, like, show for kids. The theme song. Behold, spineless masses, it's web-slinger and weapon X. Oh, crazy adventures loaded with sex. I'm punching and beer and things that go boom, robots and dinosaurs and planet-sized doom. Watch them act stupid as they're tripping through time. Something, something, something that rhymes. Best show around, everybody says so, all thanks to the genius of the almighty Mojo. And he's like, no, it's not sexy. And one of the grossest images of Mojo's face ever. As we zoom in, it's horrifying. His little tiny eyes, his massive jowls, and we get the classic Mojo, like, major domo, like his little boyfriend trying to keep everything calm, like, but this is what we desire, your lordship. He's like, it's a fun dynamic. So Mojo is ranting. He has implanted the mind of the bank teller from issue 1 in Spider-Man's brain because he wants an epic love story, and we're leaning in that direction, and that's the face of the woman Spidey was. Okay. Mojo then does a public broadcast, and this, I'll use my normal voice so it doesn't screed out. The rumors are true. I, Mojo, the Lifebringer, Wizard of the Wild Ways, producer of such celebrated shows as Uncle Clucky's Punching Hour and the all-new Exploding X-Babies, have at long last unlocked the very secrets of the cosmos itself, and from its dread maw plucked the recipe for the greatest television series in the entire history of the Mojoverse. Time travel! This is not a man you want with time diamonds, that's all I'm saying. We get more of Big Murder and the Czar. When we get a close-up of this black man, he's put time diamonds on all of his teeth, and somehow that's the worst part of this character. It's really awful. Spider-Man and Wolverine get yanked into it all, and they are having adventures, and the orb gets involved, and now this bank teller is here, and there's a giant fight, and things start exploding. The time diamonds are falling out. Alternate versions of Big Murder and the Tsar show up to warn them that things are about to get really bad. And then Wolverine and Spider-Man get to deck out themselves with time diamonds. Wolverine puts them on his claws and he's all bedazzled that way. And Spider-Man surrounds his eyes with them. And there's a moment, and this is almost my favorite in the whole series. Spider-Man says, "How is it we just bedazzled ourselves with magic diamonds and you still come out looking all tough and mean while I look like the world's worst Liberace impersonator?" That might be my favorite line in the whole thing. They kick the asses of the Tsar and Big Murder. And then a Wolverine with the Phoenix Force shows up to destroy them, just like Doom the Living Planet did. So there's something about like this event that's attracting world-ending threats. Ben, how we doing at the end of five?
But I mean, we are just like jumping the shark here. But it can be fun, I guess. I mean, I don't know. It's sometimes those points where you're writing something and you're just going like, all right, I don't even know. The story is just going off the rails and we'll follow it where it goes. And but yeah, I it kind of lost me a bit. I know writing time travel is tough. I mean, I tried to do it with Kashala and you know, I feel like sometimes a lot of it, I wish I could do it again because I feel like I dropped the ball a little bit in places and I really understand what Jason's doing here and I see the intention and I feel that it's getting there, but there's those moments where you're like, oh man,
you there's know, a lot tough. Of you're... time travel stories out there, but this feels like the movie Inception, but there's seven too many layers. Like it's just, it's yeah. too much for me. My head hurts. Okay.
Yeah. Six.
Issue six, we get more hops through time and then Spidey and Wolverine end up in the, hey, remember it's Cowboy Western Month on Gray Malkin Lane. We're finally to the old fence. Peter is living as a cowboy and he's romancing the bank teller, Sarah, who is Sarah Bailey is her name. And Logan has become the chief of an indigenous tribe, which I don't really like because he's in a full ceremonial headdress. And even though he dated Silver Fox that one time, this is a Dances with Wolves layer to this story that I didn't need. And then the Minutemen of the Time Variance Authority show up right as Spider-Man's like, oh, I found the love of my life, Sarah Bailey. We're going to live in the Old West together forever, which this man would not say any of that. His Aunt May's back at home. There is no way he's going to let himself stay in the past. The Phoenix disappears. The Time Diamonds get stolen and Dog Logan gets some of them. And then Beast appears in a random panel is like, ooh, I should create a Phoenix gun sometimes. And then Doom is like, ooh, I should become a living planet one day. And then at the end, Spider-Man is lonely. Wolverine is drunk and we're done. Jeremy, how we doing?
Well done. Well done.
I wrote the handbooks, y'all. This one was tough. This is a hard summary.
Kill it.
The wild thing is, by the end of six, we didn't need Tsar and Big Murder. Like, they're completely unnecessary to this plot. Like, you could have used any number of Spider-Man villains. You could have just given Mojo somebody. These guys' origins is convoluted, and, like, they're bad. They're bad characters. But, like, yeah, I don't know. The Sarah Bailey edition, I don't know about. I don't know how on earth that one tree would have survived these several hundred years, but I don't know.
Also, where is this tree? Exactly. Like, most trees in this area probably would have chopped down. I'm just, you know, anyway.
But did you have thoughts on Wolverine becoming, like, the indigenous chief?
I mean, you know, look, that he obviously would never have been wearing that. I mean, there would have to be so much retconning about Wolverine to make him native. I mean,
he's a white guy in a headdress here. That's the
old. Oh, I know. And that's what I'm saying. So it just doesn't track at all. Like, how would he become a chief? Where does that? It's just so much just like thrown into it to justify it being this, like, you know, cowboys and Indians kind of story. Like, I mean, it felt they like they
him, they call him Big Chief Wolverine in one panel. I'm like, oh, right. no.
Yeah. Well, do you remember there was an earlier line, I think, was it Big Murder's like, I want to go see some cowboys and Indians or something like that, right? And it was just like, yeah, right after the Knights Templar, and it was like, and then there's this, like, I don't know. It just, it didn't track for me at all. And I kind of, you know, was like, okay, I mean, why?
It's a lot. It's also like literally an anticlimax. Like in the last issue ends with like, all right, now here's this big problem we have to deal with. And it's on the first page of this one. And then they just jump past it. They just jump past the climax and they explain how it's resolved a couple pages later. And then like, there's nothing else that happens in this issue. It's all just wind down and man, and I don't know.
A bunch of like buttons put on to try to stitch up the earlier stuff.
There's some casual racism. There's some wonky time travel. There's definitely a heavy metal soundtrack. The Strong Bad reference works if I'm reading this.
Yeah, totally works.
There are pieces in continuity. The rest will never be referenced ever again. But for those of you who are Jason Aaron, Wolverine, and the X-Men fans, you now know the origin of those fucking time diamonds. So this is where they came from. Oh, I didn't even really cover that. Wolverine and Spider-Man land on another planet where the time diamonds have been harvested from. Yeah, we're it's not worth the journey that I need to take to go there. This is a wild one. I'm glad we covered it. I think it's fun, and it's fun to do this with both of you specifically. Do you have opinions on the big X-Men continuity, Ben? Like, do you love the Summers family timeline, for example? Like, do you love to get lost in that big concept shit in your comics?
I mean, sometimes I'm a sucker for canon and looking at, like, you know, connecting dots in continuity. And I think, you know, one of the things I really do love is when you can pay off for an audience something that is like a small little flavor from a long time ago and bring it back, and people that get it, you know, or really kind of just do those fun little moments where they're throwaway lines or throwaway, like, I mean, I love that scene where you saw the stuff in the where it looked like Cable's arm. Maybe it wasn't, maybe as you said, maybe it was, but it could have been Cable's arm. So yeah, I do love those things. And I remember being a kid, going back to my own timeline of reading X-Men, I would absolutely get lost in all this Summers world, you know? And I mean, it just was so much fun. So yeah, I mean, I dig it. Look, I'll be honest. If I had an opportunity to write some X-Men, which has always been one of the dreams, I would absolutely throw myself deep into that pool. So I'll just put that out there.
Given the chance, Adam X is making your lineup.
Exactly. Let's go.
Say his full Christian name, Adam X the Extreme.
That's awesome.
When I finish a book, I love to have like, fuck yeah, that was great, or oh, that was sad, or oh my god, I can't wait to see what happens next. When I finish this book, I'm like, oh, okay, I need to go for a walk. But the art is beautiful. And if you really like the high octane shit, the Phoenix Gun, the Doom the Living Planet, the crazy wonky devil dinosaur transformer, there's a lot of fun stuff here. Okay, we're gonna end our review there. Thanks everybody for joining us for this is a crazier episode. Jeremy, you've done a few of these with me now. We don't normally go this high concept. It's normally like, oh, look how Polaris and Havoc look at each other. Like this one is a lot of craziness.
Yeah, last time I or maybe it was the first time I was on here, we talked about the Avengers fighting Banshee, who was still, I don't know, a criminal at that point, just wearing a trench coat with his mutant costume underneath, walking around.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was that Captain America Country Western issue. That was fun. Yeah. The Secret Empire. Yeah. Okay, everybody, thanks for the ongoing support. It's such a joy making this show in this crazy world. I love connecting with creators. I had a great time with you both today. Follow the show at @GrayMalkin_Lane if you'd like to see regular content. I keep my own social media private because I've got kiddos. But even though I've published a few books in the past, my new big book is coming out in May. So just a few weeks after this, it's available for order. And I'll be doing the con circuit, especially in Small Press Association. So the graphic memoir version of my life story called Gay Mormon Dad is come out. I literally just got my first print copy in the mail. It's beautiful. It's moving. I can't wait for everyone to read it. On the show, please watch for the next episode coming out at the end of the month, which is The Trial of the Rawhide Kid, a full celebration of Marvel's Westerns and queer cowboys specifically. And over on the Patreon, we're closing the month out with The Apache Kid with my friend Matt Parent joining me for that.
So you can find me on mostly on Blue Sky at Jeremy Whitley, my website, jeremywhitley.com, and my podcast, Progressively Horrified, which is available wherever you listen to podcasts. podcast. It's all about horror movies, and it's all about taking apart from a progressive lens. Don't worry, it's not as serious as it sounds. It's still like we have fun with horror movies, but we also ask questions like, is Jaws feminist? Which you'll have to tune in for the answer to that one. As for stuff of mine that's coming up, in May, the third book of my series with Jamie Noguchi, The School for Extraterrestrial Girls, which is sort of a YA series about a girl who finds out she's an alien when she spontaneously combusts in the middle of class and has to go to a school for alien girls. The third book of that comes out in May. You can pre-order it right now and pick it up then. And also, as of now, my next book, which is a sequel to my previous award-winning Navigating With You, it's just called Navigating With You Volume 2, will be available late this fall, early winter, and should be available for pre-order right now. If you're looking for more queer YA romance, that's the way to go.
Excellent to see you, my friend. It's been far too long. Ben.
You too.
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram, BEarlWriter. I'm there pretty often. And also LinkedIn. I use that relatively frequently, not as much as I used to. And I also have a Substack called Look Mono Hands. I write that weekly. It is sort of a convergence of spirituality, creativity, and technology. And coming up, we're going to be dropping when this comes out, it'll be with Zoop. We'll be in our Zoop. It's not a Kickstarter. Crowdfunding for a project that I am writing and producing for a band called Fang Banger, and it's a really powerful story. They're a band that was playing throughout LA, and the lead singer died in a tragic motorcycle accident. He was also gay and was HIV positive. That's a whole part of the story of the band, and it was really unfortunate. They were about to drop their first album and he died. So this graphic novel anthology we're doing is in conjunction with the album. So each of the songs is going to be a story. I'm writing it. I've got an incredible lineup of artists that I'm working with and have pulled in. So I'm really excited for this project. And can't wait to bring it to the world amongst other things happening in the works. But this is the thing that we're in the midst of right now.
Being a successful writer these days takes a hustle. And you're both really hardworking and very excellent at your craft. It's wonderful. And thanks for being incredible allies. Thanks for being wonderful storytellers. It's great to meet you both. Can't wait to hang out again sometime. Thanks everybody for listening. We will see you all back here next week on the Graham Alkin Lane podcast. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. In March 1939, the story of Czechoslovakia didn't end with a bang so much as a quiet unraveling. Just months earlier, the country had been forced to surrender its fortified borderlands under the Munich Agreement, leaving it exposed and politically shaken. What remained was fragile, its leadership under pressure, its defenses stripped away. Into that uncertainty stepped Adolf Hitler, summoning Czech President Emil Hácha to Berlin. The meeting stretched late into the night, heavy with threat. By the early hours of March 15th, after intense pressure and warnings of military action, Hácha agreed to place his country in German hands. A simple signature. German troops entered Prague the next day, not as invaders crashing through resistance, but as a force moving into a space already softened for them. There were no large-scale battles in the streets. Instead, there was a sense of inevitability, as if the outcome had been decided long before the first soldier crossed the border. Soon after, the Nazis announced the creation of the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, a new political entity that would supposedly preserve order and stability while allowing a degree of Czech self-administration. On paper, it sounded almost reasonable. The word protectorate suggested oversight rather than conquest, guidance rather than control. Czech institutions were left standing, at least in form, and a local government remained in place. But real authority rested firmly with German officials, particularly the Reich Protector, who answered directly to Berlin. Decisions flowed from the top down, and the illusion of autonomy masked a system designed to extract resources, suppress dissent, and fold the region into the broader machinery periphery of the Nazi state. For those living there, the shift became clear not through declarations, but through daily life. Policies tightened, freedoms narrowed, and resistance grew more dangerous by the day. So what had once been presented as protection revealed itself as occupation. And then built step by step through pressure, language, and careful staging, the transformation of Bohemia and Moravia was not framed as destruction, but as reordering. And that framing, order, stability, protection, was precisely what made it so effective. We know what happened after that as the war advanced. Now we're going to jump to Captain America, Volume 5, Number 7. This is before the evil version of Captain America can come after him, the Red Skull gives one last speech. We have come so far, my brothers. Hydra has made itself known across the globe. Your strength, your sacrifice has made all this possible. And now revolution is upon us. We are striking at the very heart of the establishment, exposing their weakness and corruption to all. They fear us now as well they should. They see their regimes collapsing around them as the people demand to have their voices heard. And so, of course, they fight harder than ever to try to break our resolve. But we answer yet again. They have enriched themselves while you grow poorer. They have welcomed your enemies to the table while you feast on scraps. These sins will not be forgiven. And now it is time for us to open a new front into this war, my friends. It is not enough to merely tear down the old structures. We must also build anew that which we destroy. We ourselves must offer a better way. We will show the world what our glorious reign looks like, and they will rush to join us, laying waste to their masters. And so we will begin here in this place, Sokovia. Tonight we will break a nation and make it ours. And when it is over, they will kneel before us. They will know our true power. As we go to fight, let the call ring out, Hail Hydra! The art very much gives Hitler, during giving one of his crazed speeches, Hydra logos in red, a tentacled red skull hung all over the country as detractors are hung publicly by ropes. And in Sokovia, the streets are hit by war, poverty, and classism. Hydra steps in as a new world order, saying they are there to save the country. He's been launching a long-term military campaign and soon plans to let the rebel forces of Sokovia in so that he can turn it all to his own advantage and push the Hydra objectives forward. So to talk about this crazy story, let me welcome my dear friend Excel to the show. Excel, hello, my friend. Are you a Red Skull fan?
I can't say that I'm a Red Skull fan. I don't know how I would feel about people saying they're a Red Skull fan. Maybe they enjoy Red Skull as a villain and enjoy reading stories with Red Skull in him, but a Red Skull fan, that's a little suspicious.
There's a lot to say about that. Are you a Captain America fan? Have you spent a lot of time reading Cap comics over the years?
I haven't spent a ton of time. I did, I didn't remember this issue as vividly. I did read a lot of Brubaker's Captain America. I read a lot of stuff around the death of Captain America. I got really into that because it was Brubaker writes really good Captain America stories. And I do enjoy, like, once I kind of like realize what was kind of like the meat of Captain America rather than just like what you see at face value. I think a lot of people see it as like a like patriotism person. But like when you get down to who Captain America is and what he stands for the idea of like what America can be rather than like just patriotism for the sake of patriotism. And I think that that's something that like kind of comes out in this story too, because we get a through line of Nomad, which is like a Captain America persona that he took on when he was feeling displeased with the government. So
Nomad is not an easy character to sum up in a few words. Do you know this guy's history?
I don't. So I don't know a lot about Jack Monroe. I know a little bit about Captain America's Nomad phase, but I don't know too much about.
Let me give you the 30-second like X-Men continuity dump, right? So in the 1950s, there was a line of books called Commie Smasher Captain America. So there's a Captain America and a Bucky running around who are like not great. And they're like saying awful things and like they're the Cold War Cap. So a few years later when they
Commie Smasher
Captain America. I mean, that's not the official title, but yes.
Okay.
So in the early 60s when they brought the real Cap back, a writer a few years later decided, oh, we got to explain who these 50s versions were. So the retcon was that there was an alternate Cap and an alternate Bucky in the 1950s who were like programmed to be kind of bad. And both of those characters come back in modern comics. One of them is kind of an evil Steve Rogers lookalike. He often goes by the name the Grand Director. And then the other is Jack Monroe, who was the Commie Smasher Bucky, who ends up in suspended animation. And then he ends up as Cap's teen sidekick Nomad. And there's a lot of stories with this guy. And that's all before he comes to the Scourge.
Which I did some like looking up. So I did some reading of the history, like on the wiki page and stuff like that. I love the Scourge outfit. Like how it's like kind of bad. It's just like really over the top. And
like
I
like a horned Magneto helmet, like the whole.
Yes. It's very, I don't know, for whatever reason, it reads very like Dream Queen from Alpha Flight to me. There's something about something with horns and just an over the top outfit that I'm always going to love.
So in the 90s, Fabian Nicieza gave Jack Monroe his own title. There's a title called Nomad that runs for, I don't know, around 25 issues or so. And it's quite edgy. He is, he's got a baby strapped to his back and he's like committing gun violence in like a long, like leather trench coat with like long hair and sunglasses. And it's addressing topics like AIDS. Nicieza was writing this at the same era that he was writing like X-Force, but it's giving a voice to like sex workers and like organized crime. It's quite good. So later he's the one that turns Monroe into Scourge in the Thunderbolts.
Got it. I didn't realize he had a baby with him, like Lone Wolf and Cub style. I know that
The baby's name is Bucky.
Oh my gosh. I was just looking up the cover because I know this cover because I had a series of trading cards. I was very into trading cards and they were all number one issues. So like just the covers of comics from number ones. So I'm familiar with a lot of first issues because of that Marvel comic trading card collection. And this was one of them. So I'm familiar with the cover.
Now, are you familiar with the Axis event from a few years back where the Red Skull goes crazy and then we get like evil Captain America afterward because the Cosmic Cube rewrites Steve Rogers?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with all these?
And I call it Sixes because the marketing, the way that it's styled and you could flip it upside down. I think it's funny to call it Sixes. But yeah, it's a very shoehorned, wild event with some very interesting outcomes from it. It's not my favorite era of books. It's kind of weird taking characters and being like, and like switching the moral compass, like things are kind of that black and white or have like a direct like opposite or positive and negative of something. I think it led to some like interesting stories. Like there was some like weird Havoc stuff. There was some weird Sabretooth stuff. And then it did get us, however, an updated Onslaught Marvel Legends character or a figure. So like not mad at it for that. But it was a kind of wild event in a time where it was just event after event after event.
And when we get evil Captain America, he often interfaces with our X-Men comics. If you read like Uncanny Avengers during the Krakoa era, he's like the new Flag Smasher leading the Mutant Liberation Front. I don't know if you remember all those books. So that shows up again and again in our books.
Because he shows up, he wears the Captain Krakoa suit for a little while, right? During the Fall of X.
Yep. I forgot about Captain Krakoa.
It's a cool design. I really enjoy it.
That like plant-based weird costume. Yeah, that's fun. Yeah. That's a lot of fun. Okay, let me pause. I see the issue. So the comic I wanted you to read was Captain America's Steve Rogers number 7, like a volume. But what happened was completely fine. So again, I'll make it all seamless in post with my words. But it took me a minute to light up. Like, wait, where did that what happened?
No worries. Sometimes they're just like things are numbered really weird. Okay, I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it now. But yeah, I read the one that I read was the Brubaker, the Lonesome Death of Jack Monroe, which is just a rough read.
Yeah, that's a sad one. Do you want to talk about your feelings on the death of Jack Monroe? Poor guy.
I know. It is like you kind of see it coming throughout the issue. Like you can kind of like get a sense for how that story works and that he's not a reliable narrator. It's kind of just this sad one-shot story of the somebody who was let down by the like superhero kind of machine of just like creating super soldiers and like pumping them out and then not really taking care of anybody unless they're like, you know, popular and pretty. So it was just kind of sad to see his downfall like that and then to be, you know, turned into an unlikely, or not, maybe not unlikely, but into like an unwitting villain. Though I really did like the point where I liked how they handled the part with his daughter and like going to see his daughter and him not like that interacting.
That daughter was the baby that used to be strapped to his back.
Okay, got it. That makes a lot of sense. I really like how they handled that in the comics, in this comic in particular, where he sees her. He's like, cool, I know she's okay. I don't need to upset her by like entering into her life at all. She doesn't need that. I just want to make sure sure she's all right, and now I'm going to go take care of this other stuff.
There's something so odd about the idea of comics with the word America on the title these days. How you doing in 2026, my friend? These are crazy times.
How are any of us doing in 2026? It's wild to see, to grow up during a period where being a Nazi was the worst possible thing you could be, and then seeing like a rise of like neo-Nazism or fascism or authoritarianism and dictatorship come up so easily, where it feels like what were these folks reading that made them think that kind of thing was the good guy perspective? Yeah, like when you look at Star Wars and you're like, oh yeah, like the Empire were the rebels. Like it's a bunch of mental gymnastics that's just kind of wild to me, not to read these and kind of see what's actually going on.
Yeah, it's, I've been giving a lot of thought to that. I grew up in a really kind of manipulative religious environment. And I've been thinking about all of the thinking styles I grew up with. Somebody's temporary wellness was less important than their eternal salvation, for example.
Yes. So,
like, it's fine for you to be in this miserable marriage as long as in the long run, you're doing the thing that makes you follow all the rules. Like the way we rank priorities and like give privilege to certain people. When I think about that, this is that all magnified, and it starts to become uncomfortable, but it doesn't hit me out of the blue like it used to when I realize, oh yeah, there's an origin for all of this, It's it's intense to realize though, because it's been there for a long time. We're working hard to create joy in this world. I know you are someone who really enjoys being joyful and having wonderful things around you, and I hope you're able to do that and separate that while you're building your community out there. As always, super glad we're friends, my friend. Do you have any words of advice or thought for people?
I mean, I think it's the thing that I keep like coming back to is like a focus on your immediate community and like some of the smaller kind of unsexy political races or ways that you can get involved. I was just talking with a friend today that it's really hard to experience the feeling of being just a drop in the bucket when you don't feel like you have a chance of like tipping that bucket over or overfilling it or things like that, to keep yourself motivated when you're like, what do we even do? So I think being able to have the support of the people in your community and keep having those conversations of like, what can we do? How do we understand this? And it's important to me to be able to look upstream and see like, where is this stuff coming from? Like, where is it originating? And then look downstream and say like, what's the potential impact? And then kind of look at where are we at now and what can we do about it? I think a lot of that comes down to building that out from within your community.
Which brings us to being nomads ourselves, I suppose, if we want to bring all circle.
I mean, I don't have as deep of a V on any of my clothing, I don't think.
But you should.
maybe.
All right, my friend, it's wonderful to see you. Thanks for hanging out today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Please take care of yourselves. Living joyfully remains an act of defiance in these crazy times. We'll see you all back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane. Thanks, Excel.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.
This episode sponsored by HealthyCell. HealthyCell is different than typical supplements because it's a gel, not pills. HealthyCell uses microgel technology, which is clinically proven to absorb 165% better than traditional pills. That means your body actually uses the nutrients, so you can feel the difference. And instead of swallowing a handful of vitamins, one great-tasting gel pack can replace up to 18 pills. HealthyCell formulas are created by physicians and nutritionists to support energy, focus, immune health, and overall wellness. If you're going to take vitamins, they should actually work. HealthyCell. Reach your potential.